Hey, what's going on? Welcome to the Mile High Five podcast. I'm Doug Cunnington, and Mark Troutman's hanging out with me today. How are you?
I'm doing awesome here in Longmont. Yes, beautiful, cooler day, but yeah, nice and crisp.
Today, we're going to talk about the 4% rule, and is the 4% rule bad advice now? And I added some sub-questions in here, like, when is it good? When is it bad? And this question is from Greg, who is a supporter over on the Buy Me a Coffee page. So thanks a lot, Greg, for sending in this question. I'll read out some of the details. And if you want to have your question featured, I go to the Buy Me a Coffee area first because they support the show. And I thought, Mark, you would be a perfect person because you're very smart. And you don't need other qualifications. So you're smart, and you were
and
able
local
to come over.
And
here.
I can come over, and I was available on a whatever this is Monday morning.
Yeah, short notice, and I was like, hey, we got to do this thing. So I'm going to read the question, and several points that Greg makes here. So the 4% rule became and continues to be an outdated and now damaging remnant of the very early days of FI. So strong statement out front. Before I get into the details of why Greg thinks this is the case, Mark, did you use the 4% rule as your sort of North Star as you were going through your career, maybe as you were approaching retirement? How did it come into play for you personally?
I knew absolutely zero about the 4% rule when I was accumulating, I guess you would say. I read a book called The Wealthy Barber when I was young, and it said save, I think, 10% of everything you make. And I just decided to double that and save 20%, and then eventually raised it to 30%. So I never really had a target other than just, I want to retire at 50. I want to be able to not have to work. And if I save 30%, I'm probably going to be okay. So that was my basis of retirement planning. And the 4% rule was something I kind of learned about after I retired.
Okay. Interesting. And I'm trying to remember when I actually found the 4% rule. It must have been around like 2017 or 18. And by then we were kind of already saving a lot and decided to level out our, I guess, lifestyle creep. And we were like, the size of home is good enough and we don't need to get new fancy cars or anything like that. A couple of the big areas. And then aside from that, I think I just became more aware of the 4% rule of thumb as I got more involved in the FI community. And it was a great shorthand to make it easy to explain like the concepts or how much you potentially need to save. It's a great starting point for new people.
Yeah. And I think it evolved. I'm kind of trying to put my hat on and go back in time. And I do remember a time, and this was in the 90s when the markets were just, they were double digits every year for years on end. And I remember saying to my wife at the time, because we were big skiers and we were up and we would go to Vermont and we were weekend warriors basically. Like if we just had $1 million and we earned 10% a year, that's $100,000, we'd be good. Mm-hmm. I remember having that conversation. Yeah. And that's actually part of the reason the 4% rule was designed, because that's probably not going to cut it. And I do also remember my father saying there was a friend of his or an acquaintance or something that sold a business and he just bought tax advantaged municipal bonds, and he put enough money so that bond payment, the interest he could live off of. And mm-hmm. So that's the other extreme. It was like 2 or 3%. And he's like, well, if I put $10 million away and, you know, I mean, he had sold a pricey business.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm going to have a couple $100,000 to live on. I'm good to go. So, I mean, that was my really early basis of any concept around this. And that's, I think, why Bill Bengen actually came out with this, was because there were too many people in the 90s saying, well, you just need 10%, you know, the market's going to earn 10% a year and you're good to mm-hmm. go. And he's like, whoa, wait a minute, that math isn't going to work. And that was the basis for his research, I think.
Okay. And
so he was talking to me.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, it's not quite going to work. So, and Bill Bengen put out a book, was it last year? Did you read that?
I have not read the updated book, yeah.
I also have not read it. So we didn't prepare quite as much as we could have, but I think the punchline, it's like 5.5%.
Yeah. And I mean, we should probably back up and say what the 4% rule is. And it's basically if you, and this was for a 30-year retirement, so that's the important aspect. And the other thing was he only had enough data and statistics to use two asset classes, and he was using the S&P 500 or large cap stocks, and I believe the other was intermediate term treasury bonds. So there was a two asset class portfolio, and I believe I've heard it's either 50-50 or 60-40. I think it's 50-50, but I've heard people say it was a 60-40 portfolio, but either case, a two asset class portfolio. And then what's the worst case scenario over any 30 year period? So in other words, what is the most you could withdraw without running out of money in the worst environment? So that was kind of the gist. And that was 4%, which means that a majority of the time, it's more than 4%, right? The worst case scenario is 4%. And then the new book, from what I understand, is he's using more asset classes. So instead of just large cap stocks and just intermediate term bonds, it's small cap and some other asset classes. And therefore, potentially, it could be a higher withdrawal, worst case withdrawal rate. That's my understanding. And please correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't know if you know any different.
That sounds good to me. That's my understanding as well. Okay. Now, personally, what's your portfolio like if you're able to share?
Yeah, so high level? I do have, so it's about 30% in total stock market, about 16% in international. I do have a fund that is, and I won't name it, but it's a large cap dividend fund. When I managed money, that was the way I managed money. So I kind of like that. It's a low cost index dividend fund.
Okay. And what percentage was that?
That one is about 12.
Okay.
And then I also have Berkshire Hathaway, which is about 12. And then the rest is, so what does that add up to? I'm trying to make sure I didn't miss anything there.
12, so that's 24, then 16, and then 30 more. Yeah, so more 70,
70% equities. And then the 30% is mostly in cash and short-term treasuries. And I do have one position that is a TIP, Treasury Inflation Protected Security, and I'll explain why I have that if you want. And it kind of goes into this question a little bit. And then I do have a very small amount in intermediate term treasuries, but it's all treasuries and cash at that 30% for the most part, besides a TIP, which is also a treasury. But yeah.
What about your Bitcoin? I know you have quite a bit.
I don't have any. No Bitcoin, no small cap value, none of that stuff. And that's, you know, some of the other asset classes that people have. You know, you hear small cap value a lot, you've heard gold, you've heard commodities. I don't have any of that stuff.
Okay. Gotcha. Okay. And what's with a TIP?
Oh, so it kind of gets into this question a little bit, because I think what he's referring to here is the 4% rule. And I still think it's actually a good guideline for people to shoot for from an accumulation standpoint, like a target. Use it as, well, how much do I need to save? Like going back for me, like I said, oh, if I had $1 million and I earned 10%, I could have $100,000 a year. Well, that doesn't really work, right? But I think it gives you a good idea of what should your target B for your retirement portfolio. But then I have not really met anyone that actually lives that way in decumulation, like actually does the 4% rule as the way that they fund their retirement life. And so I follow a podcast called The Retirement and IRA Show. There are two guys out of Fort Collins. One is actually a professor at CSU that my daughter had. They're both CFPs. And they kind of, and I actually had them do my plan, because I like the way that they think through retirement planning. And the way that they do it is they're looking at covering your kind of base cost. They call it minimum dignity floor. I call it kind of base good life, with what they call secure retirement income, because like we all know, we don't know when end of plan is. So how do you plan for something when you don't know the timeline, right? It could be 30 years, it could be 40 years, it could be 50 years. You might live into your hundreds. I don't know. So covering your base costs with income that won't end is a good kind of offset, asset liability matching. So the ways you would do that is Social Security. And this is mentioned, it's either in your notes or his notes, that the 4% rule disregards Social Security. And I understand being concerned about it as a young person, because you don't know where it's going to be. You don't know if it'll be means tested. You don't know if it'll go away or whatever. But I'm in my, oh my God, I'm 60. Yeah. I don't think it's going to change much for me. It's probably going to be there. So I can count on it. So that's one way to kind of fund that base cost. For me, Social Security won't cover all of that. So how else could I cover it with lifetime income? One would be a pension, but I don't have a pension. And the other is the evil word annuity. And there are what I call the index fund of annuities, which are single premium immediate annuities, where you basically buy an annuity that is not sold because, I mean, it is sold technically, but insurance salesmen are not going to sell them because there's no commission in it. Mm-hmm. You kind of have to actively go out and buy it. Mm-hmm. But you basically put a lump sum down and it will pay you a lifetime stream of income starting within 13 months. So that's why it's immediate. Mm-hmm. It starts right away. And so what I'm looking to do is allow myself, but not necessarily force myself. So I don't want to buy it today and say, I'm going to have this annuity that turns on in the future. I want to put money aside to allow myself to make that decision later, because maybe I won't make it to, you know, 70. So I'm going to turn my Social Security on at 70 because that's the maximum that I can get, right? And I'm looking at potentially matching that or having a single premium annuity in conjunction with that will then together will cover that base cost. And so what I decided to do was put some money aside and figure out, well, what is that going to cost me? And I put a certain amount aside and I bought a TIP because it's inflation adjusted. So effectively, I can price it today saying, what would it cost me today? I can put enough aside and then the TIP itself will grow with inflation and also does pay interest on top of the inflation adjustment. But that should be pretty close to what I might need. And then at 70, I can decide, do I want to actually buy this or not?
Perfect.
So that's totally different than the 4% rule, right?
Yeah, yeah. I was like, that was a good deep topic. And I was going to say, we've talked about it. You've talked about it with Elizabeth before, that pretty much specifically that. And it's a great idea when you're thinking like, advanced, like planning, whatever for us, 30 years ahead or 25 years out, something like that. But it gives you the option. That's a great way to handle it.
Well, okay. I think what he's saying in this question is the pure and simple 4% rule doesn't take into account a lot of variables that are going to exist, such as Social Security, such as what if you live a long time, more than 30 years? Things like, what if you have to go into long-term care? What if you... So there's so many things that happen in retirement that are not this like steady, even amount that comes out of your portfolio. There's a lot of front loading. So we talk about the slow go, no go, and go-go years. Well, go-go, slow go, no go. As Kevin says, what about the mojo that comes before the go-go? So there's going to be some spending that is not smooth. And the 4% rule assumes a smooth spending trajectory. Mm-hmm. And that's just not the way it happens in retirement.
And I'll finish reading Greg's question here. And he covers some of the things. So we'll go through some of these. We'll talk about our own ideas as well. So Greg says, the 4% rule disregards Social Security, changing spending over time, creating an artificially high target, and it assumes you want the balance to remain near the same, though not the goal of many people. It often leads to another failure in a state that could have fueled a lot richer of a life and more experiences while the person was still alive. It is intended as a floor, but acts as a ceiling, and that's unintentional. It often takes away from being better. I can't read this.
Agile.
Yeah. It often takes away from better agility and dynamically based accumulation. And maybe he says it's useful for those in their 20s, maybe their 30s as a starting goal. So he covers a lot of stuff and we can
go in. So I agree with almost all of his points. Pretty much all of his points. Yeah. So I think he's hit the nail on the head for sure.
And I thought this would be a really good one. And the thing is, like, the basis of the 4% rule and, like, sort of the FI community at large, like, it's a great guideline and North Star for accumulation when we're young. It lets beginners know what they could aim for because they're like, oh, how do I even know how much I need to save? It's crazy. But it's a guideline. It gets you in the ballpark and then you could adjust from there. And your example of planning for maybe a SPIA, is that what you call it?
Yeah.
That is an advanced topic. And you don't really think about that until you're probably approaching retirement. And then after that, you have probably a few decades before you need to make that decision. So let's dive into a few of these. Now, one of the big ones is around assuming that your net worth and your balance should be this, like, roughly static the whole time. So you never run out of money. Of course, there'll be ups and downs, but the 4% rule, if you look at the data, there's, you know, some where it grows out of control because it's really good returns, and some where it's closer to ending with zero. And you're probably going to end up somewhere in the middle, maybe more on the top end. Do you know where most of them end
up? I do recall there was a Michael Kitsis research paper that went through and showed, like, a majority of people end up with multiples of what they started with. Most likely you're going to end up with more than mm-hmm. you started with. Yeah.
How do you balance this? I mean, you talk about having a pretty big cash buffer, but when you're looking at your plan and the projection over decades and you're like, I need to spend more money. What do I do? It's a great problem to have. It's a weird problem to have, but at some point you realized, hey, these returns are actually outpacing what I thought it was going to be, and maybe you underspent. So then you end up with compound interest.
I would say I definitely underspent in the earlier years of my retirement, for sure. I'm making up for that now. But I think that I will, just based on the fact that I waited a long time to do that spending, and also I'm not just trying to spend money to spend money, mm-hmm. but as... And I mention Kevin a lot because we have a lot of conversations, but he's like, when you get on the plane, you should never turn right.
Yeah.
And I was like, really? He's like, no, you should never turn right. You're in a position that is just a given. And I was like, all right, but I'm still going to calculate it out. And I'm just not sure about that. And occasionally I need to remind myself what it's like not to go left all the time. So anyway, but I think potentially you'll get to a certain point where you're just not going to spend everything. And then mm-hmm. you start thinking about, well, okay, if I'm not going to spend it, how do I want it to, where do I want it to go? And so I've had more thoughts about that. I also don't want to, you know, potentially give it to people that I think won't be, use it wisely. So I start thinking about charities. I start thinking about a lot of stuff like that. I also think about, well, how long am I actually going to live? Mm-hmm. You never know what that's going to be. But yeah, I think there will be a subset of people that get to a point where you're just not going to spend it all. And that's just, okay, so you don't have to worry about anything, but then you should try to be a good steward of it and decide, well, where could it have its best use if it's not being selfish for yourself, for example. Mm-hmm. But please don't send me a whole bunch of requests for money. It's not going to happen.
What format do you want these requests to come in? Because they're gonna come in. You could find them over at Mark's Money Mind. Let them know how you're going to manage that. People could, they're like, hey, I need to fund a charity. And you'd be like, ah, shoot. Sorry, I shouldn't have sent that idea out to people. But one thing I know in the sound check, we talk about travel. You've been traveling more. And, like, I think a lot of us in the FI community are thinking about experiences and spending time with family and friends. And you've really accelerated that. I think actually since I've known you, I think you started doing more of that. Can you talk about, was there like a switch that flipped where you were like, you know what, it's like, I'm going to go on fairly expensive trips and bring a handful of people, that kind of thing?
Yeah, I think the Die with Zero book kind of resonated with me. I think it's tough to digest sometimes because he's just got a ridiculous amount of money. So it's very easy for him to say, oh, I, you know, rented out this place and brought all my friends down. And I actually did do that, but I didn't do it to the extent that he did. And people are giving me a shit about like, well, why aren't you, where's Natalie Merchant? It's like, that's not my budget, but I did put it out there to my daughter. I said, hey, wouldn't it be cool if we could rent a house in St. Barts? Cause we'd been there many times and we were doing a cruise that ended in St. Martin that is right next to St. Barts. And I'm like, this would be a perfect opportunity. Let's see if we can rent a house and invite everyone over. And we did. And it was a great time. Everyone had a blast. It was super fun. It was just something that, and it wasn't so over the top that people were like uncomfortable with it or anything like that. It was just, you know, like I paid for the Airbnb, not a big deal. But anyway, but it was something that, I mean, that's a memory dividend that I know all of us are going to, and we were like cruising around in the island on e-motorcycles and it was just crazy. It was a good time. And I thought about it because one of the people there, Becky and Steven, were there and she's like, how'd it go? Because the last time we were there was when my wife was alive and my daughter had said, I really want to go back to St. Barts. And I was like, you know, I'm kind of uncomfortable going back because it's just going to trigger a lot of memories and good and bad and stuff like that. But because we went back with friends, she said, how'd it go? I was like, you know what? It was great because I had friends here and we were focused on showing you guys how much fun we've had on this island instead of reminiscing about, oh, my wife's not here anymore or Katie's mom is not here anymore. Right. So I would encourage people to think about experiences that if you do have the resources, maybe do stuff like that. And it could be small stuff. It could be like maybe you pay for dinner or something like that. Or I've bought tickets to Camp 5 for somebody, you know, or things like little stuff that it gives you a benefit personally, but it also obviously gives that person an experience they may not have otherwise had. So I like doing that more now if I can.
Great suggestion where it's like you could start small because like the St. Bart's thing, right? It's a little pricier probably.
Not inexpensive. But it wasn't what? Who's the author of Tyra Zero again?
Bill Perkins.
Yeah, it wasn't to that level. So
he it was like a whole like set of villas or something like that. But yeah, he's like 100 million heir or something like that. So
move the decimal a couple places for me.
different level. But yeah, you could pick up dinner occasionally or something like that for a group. And we, a couple years ago, my family came out and I got the Airbnb and they were going to pay. And I was like, it's not too bad. It was like a couple $1,000 or something like that. And I was like, great, this fits in the budget that we have allocated for travel and vacation and stuff like that. So just covered it. And then coming up, we're another kind of family trip. I'm going to pay for the hotel. Although I think I should have
points.
I should have a decent amount of points. And it's like Bill Perkins got the villas, you got a nice Airbnb or whatever. We're talking Holiday Inn. So, I mean, like I can just pay for that. It's not a big deal. But they got breakfast. They got the little waffle maker in the morning. It's great. Well, I'll be able to hang out in the lobby and there's a pool. My niece and nephew will be able to play in the pool. Mm-hmm. So it's fun. We're not too fancy. Okay. One that I like here, you don't think about it. It's the 4% rule is intended as a floor. It's guarding against the bottom.
Worst case scenario,
But it actually gives us a ceiling unintentionally. Yeah,
and I've noticed that myself. So
break this down so people understand
so
exactly.
So the 4% rule is supposed to be the worst case scenario, right? But everyone looks at it as, well, I can't spend more than 4% because I don't want to be that worst case scenario. And I think people in this community are always, it's contingency after contingency. And I did the same thing because I was like, okay, 4% rule, I get it, I understand. And this was after I retired and I was like, okay, so how much can I actually spend? And then I went down the rabbit hole of Big Earn's early retirement now. And he comes up with 3.25%. I'm like, okay, so it's not four, it's 3.25. And then I read an article on Morningstar by Christine Benn saying, you know, because the 4% rule assumes that you take an inflation adjustment every year, right? So Morningstar did an article saying, if all you do is avoid taking an inflation adjustment in the year after your portfolio goes down, it has a material impact on the survivability of that portfolio. No, so I said, okay, so now I'm doing 3.25%. And if the portfolio is down, I'm not taking an inflation adjustment. So I still have a little spreadsheet that tracks all this. And I'm like, I fell into the same trap. And yeah, you're probably going, and I talked to Big Earn. I was actually at a campfire and Kevin was like, you got to talk to Big Earn. He was my roommate. And he's like, I think Kevin wanted him to say, dude, you need to spend more money. So he said, so what is your withdrawal rate? I was like, I don't know. It's like 1.8%. He's like, you are going to end up with just a ridiculous amount of money. You got to stop that. And I was like, no, but that's all I need to spend. I'm good, you know? And that was actually one of the times where I started realizing, all right, you need to loosen the purse strings a little bit and get a little bit more comfortable. And
okay,
I probably flew economy in the back of the plane to that event and no longer.
Oh, man. Well, and
but yeah, I totally get it. I mean, it's just, it's a number out there and you want to do better. Everyone in this audience always wants to do better, right? So if 4% is the worst case scenario, I'm going to do 3 or I'm going to do 2. Mm-hmm. And I've seen people rush to like, how low can you go?
Yeah. Interesting. Yep. And Karsten Big Earn was on the show. We actually talked about Die with Zero a little bit, but we could link up to make sure people can check that out. So when you talk to him, he was like, hey man, you got to.
He said 2% is ridiculous.
It's a little too low.
Yeah. But I was coming at it from the standpoint of, but that's what I spend. That's all I need to spend. And he's like, yeah, if you want to leave a whole bunch of money to somebody, then go for it. But you know, you don't need to do that.
So one of the things that comes to mind when people run their projections is the 4% rule in the sort of subsequent studies and such. They're based on historical data, right? When people use a tool like Projection Lab, or if you have a CFP working with you and you have more sophisticated software, usually there's a Monte Carlo simulation, right? And you can correct me if I'm wrong, but historical data is 4% rule. That's what we're looking at. Monte Carlo simulation is random data. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's typically how it's run, yeah.
So it's a little more aggressive. So you have some very harsh scenarios.
Depends on how the analysis is done, because sometimes it's not going to do, let's say a worst case scenario was a down 30% year. It's not going to do a minus 30, minus 30, minus 30.
Sure, okay.
Usually it's baked into it not to allow kind of that ridiculous situation, because usually if the market's down, you know, 50%, it's not going to be down another 50 and then another 50 and then another 50. So,
okay.
But I do know that Aubrey Williams has done, he did a presentation at CAMFI on Projection Lab, and he likes to use, I think you can choose between kind of random Monte Carlo or historical like periods of time. And he likes to use worst case historical periods of time, as I recall, or at least he was showing that as an option. I'm really impressed with Projection Lab, by the way. I have no affiliation with them or anything like that, but what I've seen so far with that, it's a great DIY tool, and it was built by somebody in the FI community too.
What do you like for your projections, or do you like the Monte Carlo? Do you like historical? Do you have, you like to look at everything and you're like, you know, none of it's exactly right.
Yeah. So I belong to a Rock Retirement Club, which is Roger Whitney from the Retirement Answer Man. And he has this paid membership club that I've been in for many years. And we get Money Guide Elite as part of our software package, I guess you would say. And we're the only like client facing or customer facing people that have access to that. So it's professional level software. So I run that every year just to see. Mm-hmm. And of course you want to get a 99, right? but what I try to do is I actually run it to try to break the plan. Like what would it take to actually blow this up? And I know that some people that use Projection Lab do the same thing. Like, so I'll put in a fund number, an annual fund number, and I'll run it for like, I don't know, 15 years and just say, well, what if it was this number? What if it was this number? And find out where the breakpoint is. And that's usually the way I'm using the software, because I am typically in the 90s, high 90s. So I'm just trying to say, well, what could break this model? And again, it's because I was so conservative in those early years, which I didn't need to be. But in hindsight, I'm not disappointed that I still lived a good life. It wasn't like I was eating rice and beans and not doing anything, but I could have lived larger back then. Again, but who knows that the market would have done as well as it did over the last 10 years either. But so now I'm just like, all right, so what would break the plan? So that's kind of how I do it. But I only do it once a year. I'm not sitting on it every month and saying, yeah. Now what is my Monte Carlo number, you know?
It's funny, I was about to press you. Like, really, is it only once a year? It seems like it's a fun thing to...
Because I don't really put a lot of credit in those models.
Sure.
So, and what I do, however, is I do project out what are my actual cash flows going to be on a more frequent basis.
Mm-hmm. So probably a shorter timeline too, right?
Right.
One thing, so I've talked to a handful of CFPs over the last few years, and you mentioned your success rating is like high 90s. You're an overachiever, Mark. That's too high, right? Like generally in the 80s is a really good spot. Is that right?
I've heard a lot of different, I mean, you could argue that 50% is even reasonable. Mm-hmm. And I know Michael Kitsis's group did an article specifically on that because all that means is that there is a 50% chance that you have to make an adjustment. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean that because no one is going to like do a Thelma and Louise and run right off the cliff, right? They're not going to say, well, it says I can spend this and I'm going to keep doing it until I just literally fall off the edge of the cliff. You're going to make adjustments along the way if you see that that's kind of your situation. And that's why I do think it's probably good to do an analysis once a year just to see, am I kind of in the general ballpark of where I should be? Mm-hmm. But yeah, I would say Monte Carlo analysis, I mean, you should probably be in the 80s or 70s, 80s, realistically. And it just means what are the odds that you're going to have to make an adjustment and be agile. And they use the word agile and I agree 100% on that.
Yep. Yeah. And it's basically adjusting based on the feedback that you're getting from the system that you're looking at. And I know you mentioned Aubrey before. He did, I don't know if it's the same talk that I was thinking of, but guardrail strategy I mean, the 4% rule assumes the original study or whatever assumes you have this plan and then you never don't. And you like stick your head in the sand, you never pay attention and that is not going to happen. Like you dynamically adjust based on the psychology of what's happening. So if the market did drop like 50%, you're probably going to, even if you feel good about it and you don't take any crazy action, you're probably still going to spend a little bit less. Maybe your trips are going to be different. You won't get the first class whatever.
That's why I don't like the guardrail strategy.
Oh, go. Let's do it.
Because I don't want to have to make an adjustment. I don't want to ever be in a position where I say, well, the market's down, so I can't do that trip. And that's why I like that 10-year cash window. Like, I can spend exactly what I've determined over the next 10 years, no matter what happens, even if my equities went to zero. Now, I'd have a problem in year 11, but I don't really like the idea that I have to make any changes. So I'm not a huge fan of this, well, I'll pay myself a little bit more, but if the market doesn't go my way, I'll take a haircut. I just don't like that. Now, does that mean you're not going to do that? I mean, if we were in a situation where the economy is doing really poorly, would I just feel that I need to be a little bit more conservative? Maybe, but I don't want to be forced into that situation. Mm-hmm. So that's why I kind of like knowing that my base costs are covered and then this extra money on top is available to spend as soon as I want, whenever I want, no holds barred.
You said a phrase there that's kind of a trigger for me. You said haircut.
Yeah.
And I, sorry. Yeah, it's a little...
You don't need a haircut. You don't need a haircut.
I cut my own hair. You know, I'm saving money on that. Interesting. Well, I appreciate that. I think the guardrail is, I mean, we're not using that personally, but I think it's a great way to look at it. If someone's like, I want to be a little more dynamic, you're in a different spot where you've planned ahead and you're like, I have planned and now I don't need to adjust because maybe you oversaved in air quotes a little bit and you could have lived it up more when you were younger. I can't remember. I think it was the last episode. You had some cool cars. I think you did a lot of stuff you wanted to do. Yeah. Everything turned out fine. Yeah. But at this point, you're like, yeah, I've now planned and I don't need to adjust.
I understand the guardrails from the standpoint of the idea is that you can start off with a higher withdrawal rate than you would if you just use a ironclad 4% rule. So I get that. And they're saying, however, if things don't go our way, we need to dial back. Mm-hmm. I would never want to be that advisor that has to tell my client, hey, you know what? That trip you were planning, that you were thinking about for the last 3 years, that you were so gung-ho on, I don't think you should do it for a couple of years. Mm-hmm. Because you may not have those years in a couple of years or be in the physical ability to do that trip. So I don't like the idea of having to say to either myself or if I were an advisor, a client, yeah, you know that trip, you shouldn't really do that.
Yeah, fair. Fair. Okay. And let's see. Anything else? Well, looking at that, you don't want to do it, but do you think it's reasonable for people to expect to make some adjustments along the way?
I think everyone's going to make adjustments. Absolutely. Because you never know what's going to be thrown your way. You know, I mean, I'm a perfect example. When I retired, my wife was alive and we had all these things that we were going to do and my life totally changed. She passed away. But now my daughter is doing a lot of traveling with me and that's an aspect I never expected.
Yeah, yeah.
So we're doing a whole bunch of cool things. So yeah, life's going to throw you some curveballs. I mean, it's going to happen. I mean, maybe not to every single person, but you know, you are going to need to adapt to your current situation and you can adapt in positive ways. Like, you know, I ended up moving here. It was a great positive move, both socially and financially, as a matter of fact, because the house went up crazy over there. But I do like the idea that the word agile is a great word. And that's actually in Roger Whitney's world. That's like they're agile financial planners is what they call themselves. I think that's the name of the firm even.
Oh, nice.
Agile management. So, I mean, the whole idea that you need to adjust in retirement, I'm in this retirement group and I see it all over the place. Mm-hmm. People's plans that they thought were ironclad just change for various reasons, both good and bad. Mm-hmm. So yeah, you are going to need to adapt to your circumstances. So that's why a rigid 4% rule really doesn't make sense. And I like his last comment here that it remains useful for those in the 20s and maybe 30s as a starting goal. I think that's where it's has its most validity is just a target to get to. And then once you get there, you do need to do it more from kind of a cash flow based projection, change as you need it. Maybe spend more on the front end and you're spending less. And they talk about the retirement smile where you're spending more in the beginning of retirement. It kind of dips down in the middle and then medical costs and things at the end of your life go up. They ramp up significantly. So yeah, it's not going to be a smooth ride through retirement.
Back when I had a corporate job, I was a project manager. And planning is key. You spend a lot of time on the plan. You do your best to make assumptions that, you know, with all the evidence that you have, but basically your plan's wrong. Like,
yeah,
things are going to take longer. It's more expensive. Things are faster. Your plan's wrong out of the gate. That's the only thing you know. And you have to look at the feedback that you get. How are the trends going? And you adjust along the way. The thing is, you know, we're looking at a 30, 40, 50 year time frame. You can estimate more accurately as you get closer, but the farther it is out, then your assumptions at the beginning, like you could skew very far off. So the only thing we know, your plan's wrong, my plan's wrong, like it is going to adjust.
Yeah, you're going to have, let's say, a 30 or 40 year retirement timeframe. And if you go back, you may not even be in your 40s, whoever's listening to this, but if you are in your 40s and you go back 40 years, did you imagine where you would be today back then? Well, you might not have even been able to talk at that point, but I could back in, you know, I'm 60. So in my 20s, did I have any concept on where I would be 40 years later? Zero. You just don't know.
Yeah.
So yeah, like you said, you just gotta plan for what you think things might look like you plan for kind of a wide trajectory of it could be over here, it could be over here. And then each year you're just making minor adjustments along the path. Yeah.
I think we covered a lot when the 4% rule is good, when it's bad, that sort of thing. Is there anything else that we missed that you want to add in here before we wrap?
Now, what I like in the community, though, is that, you know, we had some very simple rules about 4%. It really was, like you said, kind of a target. What I'm really appreciative of is the tools that are coming through that are available to us individually and not necessarily have to go to a professional for, such as Projection Lab or Bolden or things of that nature, where I'm seeing now, because we had a breakout session recently at one of the events on Projection Lab. I'm like, wow, this is great. People are really getting into the details on how retirement really works, as opposed to, yeah, I'm just going to save this, and I'm just going to spend this, and everything's hunky-dory. So I would say the community as a whole is really evolving. And what's funny is I'm looking at the spreadsheet the other day for our group to Alaska, and people put in like who they are and everything. And I'm like, these ages are all moving up. You know? Yep. It used to be a lot of people in 20s and 30s. Now, you know, 40s and people 60s, 50s, 60s. I'm like, wow, okay. So, and people are realizing it's not as simple as just, you know, the simple path to wealth or whatever, or the shockingly simple math. You know, I mean, that's a good foundation. But once you really get into retirement, having more of a cash flow planning approach is really the way to go. And I think his question is spot on, that that is the way you need to kind of look at it.
Great question, Greg, and good point. I love this discussion. If people have comments out there, shoot me an email. If you have questions and stuff like that, that you want to have featured on the show, shoot me an email. Better if you're on the Buy Me a Coffee thing, I'll put a link out there. And Mark, you have a podcast of your own. We talked about it a little bit more the last episode that you were on, and you've been doing, how many episodes do you have?
Oh, it's 60 something now, okay. Something like that. So I try to publish on a regular basis, but it, you know, it depends on where I am in the world. And I used to bring all my stuff with me, and I found it was just a little challenging to try to do it on the road. So sometimes it's not as frequent if I'm out and about, but I'm usually just publishing when I have thoughts. You know, it's not like there's an agenda. It's called Mark's Money Mind. It literally is what is on my mind. And my audience is, I try to gear it towards people that are new to this, but also people that are, well, you know, experienced in this ideology, I guess you would say. So it runs the gamut. And like my latest episode was just, what was I thinking about? And I use it as a way to kind of think through things as well. So. Yeah.
It's pretty fun. Yeah. Podcasting is a good format. I like it myself, but I like the way you didn't put too much pressure on yourself. Cause like you mentioned before, like it costs money to do this and it takes time and you're like hauling equipment around and mentally, even though it's a hobby, it's like, you got to get psyched up to do it.
You know, and I tell myself sometimes, just go and sit in front of the mic and talk, and you don't have to publish it if you don't like it. And
it
always comes out, I think, relatively decent. I've never like trashed an episode. I'm just like, it's fine. Put it out there. I find what takes me the most time is the editing. I still do all of that myself, and I probably over edit. I'm always being careful about, is there too big of a gap here between words? And I should probably just let it fly. But yeah, maybe I'll talk to Chris if he's coming to economy and see how he does it for you. But I'm still doing that. So I think that's the bigger challenge, is not the actual recording so much as it is the editing and the publishing and stuff like that. But yeah.
A couple extra.
And then it's funny because I go to these conferences and people are like, oh, I love your show. And I'm like, oh, that's so nice. You know? And then I see people wearing the t-shirts. Oh, by the way, I have one for you.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, awesome. I have a new one. So this is a very special edition. Do you want a large or medium?
Medium.
Okay.
Look at this.
These are dry fit.
Oh, sweet.
And I know you guys have dry fit ones, and maybe I can get one of yours one day, but check to make sure that that's the medium one. But.
Thanks a lot. Yeah, I'll bring this at the time that we're recording this. We're about to head to economy in a couple of days. So I'll bring this. And thanks a lot, man. This is great.
So when I see the shirts around and I'm like, all right, I'm doing something that people appreciate, I should keep doing it. So
yeah. And great point. I was going to say, you published the podcast. you don't really hear much. You see people download, and I was telling you, I'm like, that's probably like a top 3% podcast, like based on the download numbers you mentioned. And yeah, when you go to a live event, people can actually go up and tell you, but you don't get that feedback all the time. And yeah. So if you see us, tell us that you like the show, because we're egomaniacs and that's what we
want. Well, it just makes it, you know, because I mean, it does cost money to do it and it takes time and everything. Yeah. And when you get that feedback, you're like, all right, this is worthwhile doing.
It's worthwhile. You know? Yeah, you do need the feedback, because the thing is, like, 60 shows is a decent amount. Like, we're in the hundreds of shows here. So it's like we've learned from it. And now it's like it has to be like a pure pursuit for us to mm-hmm. keep on with it, because we literally could stop.
And when you get those bills from Descript and Castos, you're like, oh, I guess I should keep paying this.
Exactly. Okay, so we'll link up but
support Doug's show. Go to Buy Me a Coffee and help out, because it definitely costs a bunch of money. You'd be surprised how much it costs to do this.
All right. Thanks, Mark. Appreciate it.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening to the show. That was the Mile High Five podcast, and I'm Doug Cunnington. If you dig the show, please do 3 things for us. Number 1, tell a friend, a family member, an enemy about the show. We really don't care who you tell. Maybe forward them a specific show that you know that they will like. It's the single most helpful thing that you can do to spread the word. It's like giving us a virtual high five, and actually, we don't give high fives in person, so the virtual kind's pretty good. And more importantly, your friend or family member or even your enemy will appreciate the fact that you were thinking of them. Number 2, make sure you're following or subscribed on your podcast app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Overcast, YouTube, whatever you're using, and that way you won't miss a show. And number 3, please leave us a rating and review. We read them on the show occasionally, and you might hear yours out there on an upcoming episode. Quick disclaimer. This show is not financial or legal advice. I'd actually be surprised if it sounded like it. It's really just for entertainment, and that's at least what we're hoping for. But seriously, get advice from professionals. So we'll catch y'all next week. You're an avid traveler, and if I remember right, a couple of years ago, you were away from home on vacation or a trip over like 100 and some odd days, which that's a lot. And I think a few years ago, I kind of reached the capacity where I'm like, I'm away too much. And it was way less than that. It may have been a month or 6 weeks max, probably. But how do you manage that? And how many days were you away that year I'm thinking of?
Yeah. So let's see, last year, I think I calculated it was like 150 or 160 days. And this year I was like, I don't know that I want to do that many this year. And so based on the trips I had planned prior to the beginning of this year, it was 120 days. So I'm like, all right, I'm good. But now it's creeped up. So it looks like it's going to be 150 again. But in the prior year, there was a point where I was away for, I want to say it was 8 weeks straight. And then the year before, I was away for 2.5 months straight. And that's too long for me. So this year, while it's still a lot of days, most of the trips are 2 or 3 weeks long. And they're spread out pretty well. So it'll be a 2-week trip and then come back for a couple of weeks and then go on another 3-week trip or whatever. So it's not as lengthy, I guess you would say. So even though it's the same number of days, it's just spread out better. But I do find that when I go on a trip, I want it to be at least 2 weeks, because I don't really kind of get into the groove, especially these tend to be far away and there's a lot of travel on the front and the back end. So I don't want to kind of waste 2 days of travel to get somewhere to be there only for 5 days and then 2 days back or whatever. So these are typically 2 and 3 week trips. And I find that for me, that's kind of the sweet spot. 3 weeks, it's about sweet spot.
What do you miss from home?
You know, it's funny, because being the spreadsheet geek, I kind of miss putting my numbers together. So when I come home, the first thing I do is I'm like putting in all of my receipts and, you know, where am I? And not looking at the portfolio, but just understanding like, how much did I spend on this trip and how do I organize this and is the cash flow going to work?
That's
so funny, I don't really set it up so that I can do it on the road for two reasons. One is it would be a little bit of a pain based on the way I track everything because I use Quicken and there is a way to do it online, but it's just not as clean as it is on my computer. And I also don't want to be bothered with it. So
that's so fucking funny, dude. So Elizabeth is upstairs and I was like, oh yeah, you know, Mark's coming over. And I'm like, I haven't seen him a ton. Like he travels a lot. And she was just like, I really like Mark so much. He's such a great guy. And she really likes you. And part of it is that crazy screw that's loose in your head, man, where you're like, I want to attract the numbers. I'm going to tell her that. And she's going to be like, oh wow. I like this dude even more.
Yeah.
Cause she, I think, yeah, she really wants to track the numbers. And I'm like, I'm always behind. I'm like, trying to catch the previous, but yeah, I'm just behind. She's like, I want to get these numbers in like as soon as the month ends. And she's like, oh yeah, I can reconcile last month.
I do. I enjoy bank reconciliation and credit card reconciliation. I know it's goofy, but I don't know. It's the accountant in me, I guess.
You know what you like. That's cool. All right. So you have that portion. You miss tracking the numbers. Anything else?
Well, I miss potlucks. You know, when I'm away, I don't get to do that stuff, right? So I know sometimes I'll go into a potluck and Dusty's like, where the hell have you been? I'm like, well, I was, you know, here, there, and everywhere. And so, yeah, I miss that. I miss that aspect, stuff going on here. Yeah.
Cool. That's funny. Now I remember the sound check that I wanted to do. And it's basically like, how's it going living here in Longmont? Which we could save that for some time in the future. Mm-hmm. But I think you're pretty
thumbs
happy.
Thumbs up.
Yeah. Longmont's pretty good. It's hard.
And the weather is actually, you know, I was thinking about this because I was walking my dog every day, but in Crested Butte where I used to live, it's freaking cold.
<laughs> <laughs> Yeah.
And I'm like, it's mild here. This is so nice, you know, but the mountains are right there. I was just in Crested Butte last week, so it's not like I can't go there,
right?
But I kind of like being on the Front Range here where it's not just butt cold all the time.
Yeah, yeah. And we'll get the snaps where it is, I mean, it does get cold, but then it warms right back up.
Yeah.
And I think in the mountains, in the high country, you tend to get a little more cloud cover, especially depending on which side of the mountain you're on, but like more cloud cover and overcast days in the winter, right?
Well, it's still sunny in the mountains.
Okay.
But yeah, depending on, you definitely want to know like where your house is relative to the peaks around you, because you could get dark real quick or mm-hmm. shady real quick. And there's a big difference in temperature in the shade and in the sun. So yeah, sun is a good thing.